One, hold the paper up. One, two, three.
You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, January 6, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Professor of Public Policy from UCLA, Mark Kleiman, on the benefits and potential pitfalls, the legalization of marijuana in this country. Also on the program today, potential vote to extend unemployment benefits for 3 months for those 1.3 million American workers looking for jobs when there's over 4 million people. I should say, one job for every four people looking for one across the country. Also on the program today, new study suggests fracking may impact babies' health. Meanwhile, in Texas, a brain-dead woman being kept alive against the wishes of her family because there's a 20-week-old fetus inside of her. All that and more on today's program. Well, also, we should also say Lynn Cheney. We'll get there. We will get there. First off, I would like to announce, ladies and gentlemen, that, and I will admit, to my surprise, not Matt's, but to mine, we have won the 2013 Best News in Politics Podcast Award. That's 3 years running. This is as much, if not more, a thank you to you, our audience, as it is a boast, although it's also a boast. It's facile to say we couldn't do it without you, but literally, we couldn't do it without you. You voted for us, and we won over some supposed more sort of mainstream, non-independent podcasts. Slate, I think, was in there. Democracy Now. Our audience has the mojo. I also suspect someone knows how to vote multiple times, but no, who knows? But three times in a row, essentially the first three full years of this show's existence as what could be considered as a podcast, we have won. So thank you very much for that. We will hopefully we will get our award in the mail if they can actually ship it. My understanding, the thing is huge. And so thank you again, much appreciated. Also a note for those of you who are watching the program live on our YouTube stream, you will notice that I am wearing, actually longtime viewers or listeners may know, these are my old glasses. As some of you know, in fact, I got an email from one of our listeners who had a child right around the time that Saul was born. We have been attempting to wean Saul off of the 2 a.m. feed which involved me over the past 8 or 9 nights sitting up with him from 2 to 4-ish. The other night I fell asleep. I woke up startled when he started to yell at me. I stood up. My glasses must have fallen off, and I stepped on my glasses, and they broke. So now I've got to go find a new pair of glasses.
Such is the life of Sam Cedar.
Yes, that is it. So on one hand, we get the podcast award. On the other hand, I will maybe I can melt it down and make it into glasses or something.
One hand, the podcast award. 1 foot, your glasses.
There you go. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Mark Kleiman.
Paid my dues, time after time. I've done my sentence, but committed no crime. And bad mistakes, I've made a few. I've had my share of bad kicks in my.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of Public Policy at UCLA, Professor Mark Kleiman. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sam, a pleasure.
So let's put into context for us I guess as of 4 or 5 days ago, Colorado's legalization of marijuana took effect. We anticipate this is going to happen in Washington State in the coming months. But put into a broader context for us what this represents and just how far this legalization goes on the spectrum of, I guess, decriminalization, legalization.
Putting aside for the moment the fact that it's still illegal federally, which is going to complicate things. Washington and Colorado have gone about as far out as you can go on that spectrum. So they've lurched directly from full prohibition to commercial legalization, more or less on the alcohol model. And there are a bunch of regulations, and there's some taxes. But pretty much cannabis is going to be a commodity like other commodities. And there were a number of intermediates that they skipped over that I might not have skipped over on the way there. But that's the direction they're going, and we'll certainly learn a lot from their experience.
Well, I want to talk about what those steps would be. But is this, I mean, am I right in understanding that this goes further than we have seen just about anywhere? I'm not just in this country, but just about anywhere in terms of cannabis becoming another commodity?
Correct. There are provinces in India where bhang, a cannabis drink, is openly sold. Other than that, it's illegal everywhere in the world, including the Netherlands. The shops in the Netherlands are tolerated, but what they're doing isn't strictly legal. And production is strictly illegal, and people actually go to prison for it. So that the shops in the Netherlands sell cannabis for about the same price that the medical outlets in California do. I think it'll be much cheaper in Washington and Colorado when things settle down.
I think that comes as a surprise to most people. I mean, I don't think people. I feel like the leap that has been taken here is sort of underappreciated.
Yeah, but I mean, this is partly the problem of legislating by initiative. you need something you can put on a bumper sticker in a 30-second spot. That's partly that if you say to an American, well, we're going to legalize something, the model that comes to mind is alcohol. For-profit producers, for-profit retailers, and a state regulatory mechanism. And so that's what the people in Colorado and Washington wrote into the law.
All right, let's take Colorado first. I know that you have consulted with the Washington Alcohol Bureau in their attempts to legalize cannabis. Let's start though with Colorado. Tell us what is happening there. What is the regulatory regime, and what steps you would have taken if it were up to you to have brought us to this point, and why? I guess that's a big question, so I'll remind you of
sure.
part of it as we go.
So Colorado had very wide open medical marijuana. About 3% of all adult Coloradans had a medical card. And what they basically decided to do is convert the medical outlets into commercial stores. They're going to basically change the name over the door and not require a doctor's note. And other than that, they're still in business now the way they were in business 2 weeks ago. So that, in some ways, it's a fairly smooth transition. In addition, any Coloradan, and this has been true now for a year, any Coloradan can grow up to 6 plants at home. 6 plants is a lot of marijuana. So the taxes are modest, 15% at wholesale, the additional sales tax. But on the medical side, the prices had already been falling pretty substantially. Now, because there are only a limited number of licensed stores now, and there were people coming in to buy, they were able to price gouge the first day, and I'm sure the prices will stay high for a few months. But I think we're going to see them going down heavily after that. The regulatory agency is the Revenue Board. And as in Washington, the marketing restrictions are all about marketing to children, but there's no limit on marketing to adults. And the usual, you know, you can't drive drunk and so on.
And so now, what would you have taken from a public policy standpoint? Would you have taken different steps? I mean, would there have been an intermediate period in your mind, or what would you have done differently in Colorado?
Well, so let me back up in sort of good policy analyst fashion from what we should do to what we're trying to accomplish.
Okay.
All right. So the place to start is, you want to legalize cannabis because you're tired of a big illicit market. Cannabis market's probably $35 billion a year now. It's a lot of money to give to bad guys.
And this is not to mention the implications of the cost of the so-called war on drugs, both in terms of what it does to people caught up in it and what it does to law enforcement.
Yes, but the implication, the part of that that has to do with cannabis is way overstated. We have about 500,000 people behind bars at any one time for drug law violations. About 40,000 of those are cannabis, on a generous count. So if you think we can get rid of the drug war by getting rid of cannabis prohibition, think again. If we wanted to get rid of the bad consequences of the drug war, we'd have to legalize cocaine and meth and heroin. And I don't see that coming. What we do get rid of is about half of all drug arrests, because most drug arrests are civil possession of cannabis. And so that's 650,000 people a year who don't get busted. That's a good thing. And there's certainly some neighborhoods where cannabis dealing is a major problem. But the notion that the drug war is a bad thing and then therefore we should legalize cannabis just doesn't add. Still, we can get rid of the costs of cannabis prohibition, which are substantial. We can make cannabis available to people who like to use it and don't get harmed by it. That's a good thing. We can increase personal liberty, and that's a good thing. We can take 30 million Americans and move them to the right side of the law. That's a very good thing. So those are all the pluses of of legalization. Oh, and we can provide cheaper and better products to the consumer, which, you know, in any other market we would consider a good thing. There'll be more product variety. Both in Colorado and Washington, their product will be tested, both to be certified as free of impurities, but also to be labeled with its chemical content. So consumers will have the capacity to know a lot more than illicit market consumers can know about what's actually in the pot they're using, how strong it is, what the ratio is of THC, which is the primary intoxicant, to cannabidiol, which is an anxiety reliever and a buffer. So all of that's good, but it's possible that people will wind up using cannabis in safer forms once it's legal and they know what's in it. Eating, for example. I mean, pot brownies, I think, are a terrible idea. There's no way to know how much is in them. And once you've swallowed the brownie, you're along for the ride. And there's right. No way to have a little and then decide, you know, whether you're stoned enough. Well, but if the brownie comes labeled, as it will both in Washington and Colorado, with precisely what's in it, that may actually be a safer way to use cannabis because it comes on more gently. There's a different risk about the brownies, which is that at some point, you know, the six-year-old is going to find mommy's brownie stash.
Right.
And that's going to be a bad scene. I actually don't think we should be selling sweetened edibles. There's no way to make them unattractive to kids, but that's a longer story. So there are big advantages of legalization.
Before we get to the negatives, let me just ask one more question about the drug war. In the event that things go as one would hope, I mean, ultimately, and it basically makes the black market for marijuana obsolete. Does that have implications for the bad guys, as you call them, in terms of smuggling routes and this and that? I mean, does it in any way hamper their business on the larger the importation of other drugs?
Probably not. It will certainly put some crimp in the profits of the big Mexican drug trafficking organizations. And that's probably a good thing for Mexico in terms of violence. But you're looking at maybe 25% of their drug export revenues being cannabis. It won't touch, of course, their domestic, you know, in Mexico drug sales, or their non-drug activities of, you know, kidnapping and extortion and so on. But no, I would not expect to see the legalization of cannabis make it harder to smuggle cocaine. I don't see how that works.
Right. I mean, obviously, I guess it's harder in some respects to smuggle cannabis simply because it's just
much harder.
More of it, right? I mean, it just
right. Exactly.
Okay. So exactly. And so, what are the negatives involved in these in terms of the outcomes?
The negative is that some people who use cannabis use it to their own harm. Either they use too much of it, or they use too often, or they use it on the wrong occasion. It's especially true for minors. The evidence is disputed in terms of what's going on in the brain. But I don't think there's any doubt that, you know, a kid staying stoned through high school is probably not learning as much as he would be if he were straight. And when you make something much cheaper, much more available, remove the social stigma, remove the legal penalties, and have an industry aggressively marketing it, and note that the industry can't make any substantial money by selling to responsible users. They simply don't use enough. The minority of users who are using enough to really hurt themselves make up most of the market in volume terms. Hmm. So the interest of the industry is exactly opposite of the public interest. You know, also true for gambling, also true for alcohol, also true for tobacco. Any addictive activity, the market is dominated by the addicts, even if they're, as they always are, a minority of the total users.
Interesting.
And so the downside is more drug abuse. And the question is how much more? And nobody knows. Now, look, we may get a bonus here. It's possible that additional heavy cannabis use will replace heavy alcohol use, in which case we're way ahead of the game. And advocates always insist, oh, of course, you'd rather have people stoned than drunk, which I think is true. What we don't know is whether they get stoned in addition to getting drunk. It's entirely possible that legal cannabis will mean more heavy drinking rather than less. And that's just something we're going to have to watch out for. Now, both Washington and Colorado have rigidly separated cannabis from alcohol. You can't sell them in the same place, and you can't sell a mixed product. So far, so good. But the lower the price, the greater the risk of heavy use. And I think both Colorado and Washington like to see quite low prices. And again, I don't see any justification for allowing marketing. The lawyers in Washington told the liquor board, well, you know, the Supreme Court's commercial free speech doctrine says that once you've made something legal, you can't limit it to marketing except to kids. I doubt that's good law, but that's what they said. And so, you know, you'll have girls in bikinis outside the stores.
And so, I mean, what do we know in terms of, I mean, because I'm always struck by, in some respects, how little we know about pot in terms of research, because it's been illegal to sort of, we just haven't had any models in some way,
right,
to sort of get research. How do we know that there
what's ironic is that even when pot is legal to buy in Colorado, you still can't use that pot for research. The only stuff you can get for research is from the University of Mississippi lab, which is not very much like the stuff that's actually on the market these days.
So it's against the law in Colorado to do research with pot that you buy in Colorado, or
it's not against the Colorado law, but it's against the federal law. Remember,
right,
it's still illegal federally. And if you went to your Human Subjects Committee, your institutional review board, and said, you know, I'm going to buy some pot on the market and use it for research, they're going to say, no, you're not. The FDA won't allow it.
Wow. That
yeah, no, that is a piece of stupidity in federal policy that needs to be fixed.
And how do we know that, I mean, maybe it's just simply basic economics, but how do we know that the lowering of the cost of pot will increase abuse of pot? I mean, you know, because it, you know, we were just talking in the office, you know, that as, you know, and I was a kid, you know, a long time ago, we're talking 30 years plus, but it was easier for me to get pot in high school than it was alcohol.
I keep hearing people say that, and I keep looking at the data that something like 90% of high school seniors have had alcohol. And I just wonder how hard it could be to get when it's in your mommy's liquor cabinet. And when, you know, every liquor store has a drunk outside who will go in and buy you a six-pack in return for keeping one of the bottles. I
mean, my dad would put, like, lines on the bottles. I mean, it was... But I imagine not everybody was so diligent. I mean, that's what I'm asking. Is that, I mean, do we have, has there been substantial research on that?
I mean, as you say, it's Econ 101 that when price goes down, consumption goes up, right? That's the law of demand. It's the best verified generalization in all the social sciences. The key fact, but, you know, I mean, if it doesn't very much matter very much to people who smoke a little, because it's a pretty cheap intoxicant. Think about it. If you're a naive cannabis user, a tenth of a gram of the stuff that now sells for $10 a gram will get you nicely stoned. So that's, you know, a dollar for a couple of hours of intoxication. It's a much better deal than beer. So if that price goes down a little bit, it probably doesn't matter very much to the casual user.
But
the
for
the person who's got a tolerance and is using 3 grams a day, cannabis is now an important part of his personal budget. And so price decrease is gonna increase heavy use. The other place it matters is to kids who don't have much disposable income.
Right.
So all the studies I know suggest that marijuana is somewhat price elastic. And, you know, we'll see. Now, there's a bonus that might be coming. Particularly young people who smoke a lot of pot often finance it by selling illegally. And legalization will take away that market. And some of those people may have to smoke less because they can't afford it. But let's note that in Colorado and Washington, it's illegal to sell cannabis to anybody under 21. So about 20 to 25% of the cannabis market is reserved for illegal transactions. I'm hoping that as for alcohol, that'll mostly be diversion from the legal market. You know, people buying it legally and then, you know, giving it or selling it to minors. Because the alternative is the black market keeps running.
Right. And so so now that we've sort of identified the both the positive and negative outcomes that we want from a policy, what would you have done different in the case of Colorado? And I guess this also speaks to what you to a certain extent what you consulted Washington State. What would be a better way to achieve the positives without the negatives?
Right. So what you'd like to see is high prices. I see no benefit from letting prices fall. You'd like to see good consumer information, you know, about the chemical content and about what that means psychologically. And the problem is, again, the science hasn't really been done enough. But I'd like the people selling cannabis to act more and have the training more like pharmacists than like bartenders. So it's cannabis is a more complicated drug than beer, right? Beer has a single active agent in it, and you know how much. Cannabis has at least 3 and maybe 50 active agents. I'd like to have limits on marketing. I mean, in my view, there's no reason to let the sellers do anything but have a website that, you know, gives the chemical content. And you want to keep the price high. And in order to avoid the situation where you've got sellers who are trying to make money by creating more drug abuse, you might want to have a non-commercial business. You could limit it to not-for-profits, or you could have state stores. Now, you couldn't have state stores right now because the state government can't have its employees commit federal felonies, which selling pot still is. But that's the direction I'd like to see it go in. The radical idea that I'm putting out there is, why not have everybody who's a cannabis buyer set a personal quota? Right, so you come in, you might want to say, in order to become a cannabis buyer, you have to pass a test, like a driving test, just so people have memorized some facts. All right, Mr. Cedar, congratulations. You know, you've passed your test. We're now signing you up as a cannabis buyer in Colorado. As you remember from the test, the joint contains about 40 milligrams of THC. How many of those would you like to use every month? And we're going to set that as your personal quota. And every time you buy, it'll be taken off your quota. And if you've used up your quota for the month, the guy at the cannabis store will say, sorry, Mr. Cedar, can't sell you anymore this month. If you want to raise your limit, you can, but that doesn't take effect for 2 weeks. So this is a simple nudge strategy, asking people to make a long-term plan about their cannabis use that will control their short-term behavior. But it would help everybody.
I imagine, I got to imagine, though, that I wouldn't be terribly comfortable with somebody having that data. You know, I mean, because, at one point it becomes...
Sam, I'm sorry to tell you, Visa already has that data.
Visa does.
Yeah, of course they do.
I would probably buy with cash. I mean, I guess, mm-hmm. to the extent that,
But you're assuming that cannabis use is somehow problematic. It's now a legal activity.
Well, I'm not sure, frankly, I would want a potential employer to say, hey, I've been noticed you drink a lot of tequila. Or,
No. Look, obviously, you'd want to privacy protect that information.
Right.
I didn't even put it under HIPAA rules. I can imagine problems with it, but the advantage of making people more mindful about how much cannabis they're using and allowing them to make a determination, when they're not in the heat of the moment about how much they want to use. I mean, look, all I know is if I had to choose my monthly diet at the beginning of the month, I'd weigh less.
Yes, I mean, but that's also an argument maybe for that as well, right?
No, because you can't do it for food. I mean, food is too integrated into other things. I mean, I just can't imagine a system for actually doing that.
Right.
But cannabis is, it's fairly straightforward. And yes, I do it for alcohol too.
Right.
Sweden used to have an alcohol quota, not users yet. And when they got rid of it, alcohol abuse went up naturally.
And so, and in terms of maintaining the price of cannabis, you would obviously do this through taxation. In fact, I mean, I think
you can do it through taxation. You can do it the equivalent through quantity limitation, right? If you issue license to grow only a certain amount,
to maintain sort of a curb on supply,
right. Or you could have state stores and simply, do it as profit rather than tax.
And, it seems that the sort of the dilemma here is that, and this, I guess, speaks to why you are concerned about referendum driving this as opposed to sort of sensible policy, is that it creates this sort of vacuum where... it's almost the difference between letting the cows run through the street, the town and develop the streets rather than having the municipal government sort of say, here's a grid, which is going to make it a lot smarter for our transportation.
Right. Though, as somebody pointed out, Boston is a more livable city than Washington because cows are better at urban design than Frenchmen.
Well, there you go. But that's not the case in your mind when it comes to the legalization of cannabis.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly think it ought to be done on an experimental basis, and nothing I just said should overrule the experience we actually have. But, yeah, I don't think there's any reason to imagine that unrestricted profit maximization is going to get us the best outcome for any activity where a substantial number of people wind up not doing what they really want to do. If you make the really kind of one-on-one assumption that everybody does exactly what will maximize his own welfare, then full legalization follows automatically. But I just don't think that's a sensible thing to say about abusable drugs.
And so give me your sense of, basically what we have here is two experiments, Colorado and Washington. And to a certain extent, what I'm hearing you say is that we've just got to sort of wait and see how this plays out. Just based on, and part of this obviously is just sort of based on your experience and your study, but give me a sense of where you think things are going to lead to in Colorado, and then sort of contrast that with where you think they're going to lead to in Washington.
I don't think the differences between Colorado and Washington are substantial to start with. I think eventually Colorado's prices are going to be substantially lower. Are going to be noticeably lower One thing you're worried about in both states is that if the prices fall low enough, you could wind up having people buy at retail in Colorado for export to other states. I'm not too worried about diversion from the licensed producers. I think that's reasonably easy to control. But if the price falls so low that retail in Colorado is below California wholesale, then you could have pot dealers from across the country simply organizing teams of people in Colorado to buy an ounce at a time. Other than that, I think they're pretty similar. And again, I'd like to see other approaches tried as well. But I don't think there are going to be any very bad consequences in the first couple of years, right? I mean, if the things I'm worried about happen, they're going to happen relatively slowly. And so I think a year from now, 2 years from now, Colorado and Washington are going to look pretty good, and the trend in public opinion is for legalization anyway. So I doubt that the country's going to wait to, get long-term results from those two before plunging ahead. I think California is very likely to legalize in 2016.
And so, and are you concerned that there's going to be a certain sort of headlong rush into this, or is this a net positive ultimately?
Well, what I'm saying now is prohibition is probably the worst way to deal with cannabis, and alcohol-style commercial legalization with modest taxes and regulations may well be the second worst. And what I'm worried about is that we're going to get locked into the alcohol model in one state after another, and when Congress finally gets around to legalizing at the federal level, which I'm predicting sometime in Hillary Clinton's second term.
There's a lot of predictions.
That's the model.
There's a lot of predictions in that one prediction, but go ahead.
We're going to be locked into the alcohol model, and we're just going to wind up with another greedy, aggressive industry that generates as much drug abuse as it can and resists all attempts at effective taxation and regulation.
And by that point, their lobby, and we're talking about sort of a corporate commodity lobby, is going to be strong enough to prevent any type of sort of reasonable, almost retroactive regridding of the streets, as it were.
Right. That's what I'm worried about. And also, of course, sort of the libertarian impulse. You're going to have Republicans, when they switch their position on cannabis legalization, lurch directly from "you should go to jail from selling it" to "don't interfere with the free market." Right. We already saw that in Colorado. The Republicans in the legislature were arguing for lower cannabis taxes.
Right. And
this is not the political atmosphere in which the stuff I want is going to be easy to do.
And so if you were to sort of, a policy standpoint, it seems to me that you would advocate the sort of the federal government getting out in front of this and creating a regulatory regime that is going to prevent what you perceive to be some of these pitfalls.
Right. So one version of this is you could leave the federal law in place and have a system of policy waivers the way they did welfare reform. If your state wants to have something other than marijuana prohibition, come to the Attorney General, explain what you're going to do to control drug abuse. And, if it looks like a reasonable system, then the Attorney General can give you, your state, a waiver from the federal law. And then what goes on in the state is actually legal at the federal level. And have that be pretty tight. And that would solve problems like, right now, people who are in the cannabis business can't have bank accounts because the banks can't deal with them because it's criminal income. So I think we need to deal with the federalism problem. And yes, in dealing with the federalism problem, we might put some fairly tight restrictions.
And there's sort of a de facto, sort of much messier, not as effective relationship between the federal government in Colorado and Washington now, right, to that effect, right, where the DOJ said, look, I mean, here's our just sort of broad, loose parameters, but it really had more to do with sort of interstate, I guess, importation or
Right. So they're worried about interstate, organized crime, weapons, money laundering, access to kids, drunk driving. That's not the full list, but that's pretty close. The problem is they waited for Colorado and Washington to set up their policies, and then they issued the memo. There was no negotiation that I know about. And a number of things that I would have asked for from the states, you know, never got on the table. I mean, they didn't say, for example, we're going to tolerate this as long as the price doesn't fall more than 20% below the illicit price, which I think is a very important objective, not on DOJ's radar at all. Nothing about marketing restrictions.
And so in terms of price, you would want the price to be maintained at a level that still makes it an issue as to abuse, but not so high as to make the black market continue it to be viable.
Right. And I think that the quality advantages in the illicit market will be great enough so that it can compete very well with the black market on an equal price basis. I think it would be very, very hard to sell black market weed in competition with stuff that's tested and labeled. And I also think that it looks to me in Washington and Colorado as if the trend is going to be toward concentrates rather than toward herbal. And you know, the concentrates are a little more complicated to produce on the illicit market.
Well, what do you mean by concentrates? Think, like tinterns? Is that what is that? I have friends from California, and so I'm aware of things like those strips the breath strips. But apparently, they have it now for marijuana or.
Yeah.
Like a marijuana essential oil or something. You take a drop
right.
With a droplet.
Right, exactly. And those and the liquids can be put in vaporizers, you know, like e-cigarettes. And so you're not burning anything. And I think that's got enough advantages, so that seems to be growing in market share. And that's a product that the illicit market is not going to do very well with. I think wiping out the illicit market is not very hard, particularly if you do some enforcement.
Interesting.
And therefore, I wouldn't want the illicit price to fall very much.
So we can, I guess, we're looking somewhere around 2022 in your estimation as to. The federal government legalizing it as well, and by that point we could have half a dozen, 20 states that have legalized it.
As Heisenberg and Yogi Berra both said, predictions are dangerous, especially
right.
about the future. But yeah, I mean, a couple of years ago I was saying, if the trends in public opinion continue, we're likely to get national legalization in 10 years. Now, given the latest polling, I have to say, unless something comes along to dramatically reverse the trend in public opinion, we're going to legalize. And I don't see what that's going to be.
Can I just ask you, just like in general, I mean, finally, what has changed? I mean, I seem to remember that during Jimmy Carter's era, there was a sense that marijuana was going to be legalized. Was it basically just the Reagans? That, I mean, why has it taken so long, or why is it happening now?
Well, so there was a dramatic reversal, sort of at the end of the Carter administration. There had been a strong trend toward decriminalization, not legalization, but a strong trend with the president behind it. And then Peter Bourne's misadventures as Wayne's drug czar, plus the survey that showed that more than 10% of high school seniors were getting stoned every day. And a generally conservative wave led the Carter administration to reverse itself on cannabis. And then Dan Reagan came in, and we were just saying no. Partly, I think, cannabis got caught up in concerns about other drugs. Partly it got caught up in concern about crime. Partly it just got caught up in the backlash against hippieism, if you will. And as to what's happening now, it's partly generational. You know, the opposition to cannabis legalization has always been strongest in the generations that didn't ever use it. And those generations are now a smaller and smaller fraction of the voting base. It's also true that the boomer generation was pro-pot when we were in college, or you know, the equivalent age, got to be anti-pot when we had kids, and now the kids are out of house. What's interesting is that the subsequent generations are strongly pro-pot, even if they've got kids at home. And again, it's really not so much pro-pot as it's anti-prohibition.
Right.
Part of what's happened is the market's grown. I think a lot of people are saying more or less what I'm saying, which is, you know, cannabis prohibition may have been an experiment worth trying, but it's broken down. I mean, the way alcohol prohibition broke down. And so even if you think that a big increase in pot consumption is a likely consequence of legalization and a bad thing, you could still look around and say, look, this is not sustainable. And in fact, that seems to be where public opinion is not so much pro-pot as anti-prohibition.
Professor Mark Kleiman of UCLA, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate the time.
Sam, it's always fun. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. All right, bye. Folks, there you have it. Interesting stuff. And a prognostication about the 2016 election built in, and
he
the 2020.
He didn't even miss a beat, which I enjoyed that.
Yes.
You're like, there's a lot of assumptions built in there. He's just like, yeah, Hillary's going to be president. Anyways, back to weed will be decriminalized in 2018 at noon.
All right,
that sounds like big weed. We got to be afraid of big weed now.
Yes.
Along with big alcohol, big
cut
pharma.
Cut to the majority report in 2024, and I'm railing on big weed for their practices.
Big weed just contracted a newly reemerged Frank Luntz.
That's right. And then you'll have all the sort of the folks in 2024, what is now Brooklyn, of course, that will have to move north because of the rising sea levels. So that will probably be somewhere around like Kent, Connecticut, making artisanal marijuana, fighting the big weed industry. All right, folks, we're going to take a break, head into the better half of the program. You can call us at 646-257-3920, wherein we will play that sound from, who was it, from Cardinal Timothy Dolan, retelling a wonderful heartfelt story about the billionaire founder of Home Depot and how he's... he's now basically conditioning his charity for the Catholic Church on some interesting it's interesting what they'll stand up for, some of these guys. Also,
child molestation is one thing, Father.
Right.
When you talk about my top marginal tax rate.
Please. We're going to have a problem here. Also, this horrible story of this brain-dead woman in Texas, and against her family's wishes, she's being kept alive because there's a fetus inside of her. Also, more on the minimum wage and the potential for an extension for unemployment insurance. This fracking study and the sad, sad story of Lynn Cheney, who apparently will not be a senator from Wyoming. And I guess there's some health issues in her family. I wonder if she just found out that her dad has no heart. All that and more, plus your phone calls, 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can IM us through the app. Get the app. I don't know why you wouldn't have the app by now if you have any type of smartphone. Get the app. Listen to the show live. Listen to it as a podcast. Maybe we'll include ultimately some sounds that apparently are coming from outside the studio. I think either we're having some type of the building is being torn down, or I don't know what's going on.
We have measuring people wandering around the halls of our building today.
Yeah, I don't know what they're using to measure.
They were like, "Can we measure your studio?" And then they came in and like for they literally like, 5 seconds, and they were like, "We got it.
Small. Small is enough. The small you have the yeah. smallest.
Small.
Yeah."
Like, oh, this is a small left-wing podcast. Got it. Later.
All right. We'll be back in just a moment. If you want to support the three-time award-winning podcast, The Majority Report, we need your support. You can become a member today at majority.fm. As always, if you don't have the financial means, please email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will give you access to the funner half of the show. You can also support this program by buying your Amazon crap through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Just go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, always buy your Amazon crap through there. We get a kickback.
It's supposed to be really cold. I wonder what helped with that. Maybe a nice hot cup of coffee.
Nice. You can get that at justcoffee.co off Fair Trade Coffee, tea or chocolate. My understanding is like 15 below in Madison, Wisconsin. Why not order from justcoffee.coop? Fair Trade Coffee, employee owned. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off coffee, tea or chocolate. Give us a review on iTunes. Share the show. Give us a review for the app or the podcast. You see somebody with a smartphone, tell them that they should get the app. It's completely free at majorityapp.com. Great way to spread the show. Folks, GM just announced that Chevrolet, I think, is making a deal to have 4G service in all of their new cars in 2014 or 2015, I think it is. This is basically what I have been claiming will be the biggest boon to this show. But we need to build the show size and exposure in anticipation of that.
So when this becomes the norm, we will be on the top game in town.
That's right.
By the time that becomes the norm.
That's right. And I say that as progressive talk radio is dark now, at least commercial talk radio in New York. And in L.A., WWRL in New York just went all Spanish. KTLK in California became conservative. So spread the word. If you're on any of those forums where people talk about liberal talk radio, please tell people they can stream the Majority Report now.
And not just any Majority Report, the three-time straight award-winning political news podcast Majority Report.
Thank you, Matt. What'd you do?
No one gets more excited about the podcast awards than Matt.
All right, folks, we'll be back in just a moment.